Good evening, I'm Naomi Steinberger. I'm the Director of Library Services here at the Library of the Jewish Theological Seminary. And we're here this evening as part of the library's faculty book talk series, where we highlight various faculty members who've published new books over the course of the year. It's a wonderfully successful series, and this is the last one of this season, but come back next season and we now have your contact information and we can put you on a mailing list so that you find out about these series. We're here to celebrate the publication of the exhibition catalog, Uneasy Communion, Jews, Christians, and the Altarpiece of Medieval Spain, which is edited by Dr. Vivian Mann, who is also one of the three contributors to the catalog. And her essay, Jews and Altarpieces, will be the topic of tonight's talk. Just a bit of background about Dr. Mann. She's the director of the Master's Program in Jewish Art here at JTS. She served as the Morris and Eva Feld Chair of Judaica at the Jewish Museum for many years, where she created many exhibitions and their catalogs. And the one that's connected to tonight's event was her Convivencia, Jews, Christians, and Muslims in Medieval Spain. That's probably what got her started on all of this, I think, and has done other more recent on Jews of Morocco, Jews of Italy, etc., etc. In the year 2000, her book, The Jewish Text and Visual Arts, was published by Cambridge University Press. And in 2005, Art and Ceremony in Jewish Life, Essays on the History of Jewish Art, was published as well by Pindar Press. Dr. Mann has received many academic awards, Woodrow Wilson Fellowship, fellows from the NEH and NEA. She's a fellow of the Institute of Advanced Studies at the Hebrew University and has been awarded the Jewish Cultural Achievement Award by the National Foundation for Jewish Culture. The exhibit that accompanies this catalog is currently on display at the Museum of Biblical Art on Broadway and 62nd Street under the same title. I urge you to go to see the exhibit if you haven't seen it yet. It is magnificently displayed, and I think that tonight's talk will whet your appetite even more to go see these magnificent altarpieces and some very famous manuscripts as well. One of the significant points that Vivian Mann makes in both her essay and in the exhibition labels is the impact of Jews in Christian life and even in their religious life in medieval Spain. She points out specific Jewish elements such as hair, both facial and hair color, use of Hebrew texts, use of special Jewish halos, and scenes from the Old Testament that are all found on the altarpieces created by both Jews and Christian artists. She also suggests that Jewish art, the art of the Jewish illuminated manuscript, is not an isolated phenomena and should be considered as coexisting with overall Spanish art of the medieval period. Dr. Mann's talk tonight is entitled An Odd Coupling, Jews and Altarpieces in Medieval Spain. And I welcome Dr. Mann. Thank you.
Living as we do in a time of religious fanaticism without boundaries, it is hard to imagine a period when Christians, Muslims, and Jews live together in relative harmony. And when we do think of that time, what comes to mind usually is the Golden Age under Arab rule in Spain of the 10th and the 11th centuries. It was a period when the minority Jewish population flourished amidst that the culture of the majority. Christian rule, however, over the peninsula is most often associated with the expulsion of 1492 and the pogroms of 1391 that preceded it. Tonight, I would like to discuss a period after the Reconquest, the years between 1300 and the expulsion of 1492, when cooperative relations existed between Christians and Jews in the domains of Castile and Aragon, particularly in the role of Jews as artists, as painters of altarpieces, illuminators of manuscripts, and silversmiths. In the 14th and 15th centuries, Jewish artists worked alongside Christians, despite the negative pressures on Jewish life such as forced conversions, blood libels, and charges of the desecration of the host, all of which culminated in the pogroms of 1391, when thousands of Jews were killed and thousands more converted, leaving the remaining Jewish communities decimated and impoverished. To give one example, Abraham de Salinas, a Jewish painter in the capital city of Saragossa, was commissioned by La Seo Cathedral to paint a retablo, a large altarpiece installed behind the altar, on the life of the Virgin in 1393, just 2 years after the worst pogroms in Spanish history, although I must be honest and tell you that Saragossa was one of two communities that escaped these pogroms. Bonafos Abansu, a Jewish silversmith, contracted to provide the frame for the altarpiece. Later, Abraham created two other retablos for the Church of San Felipe in Saragossa, one on the life of San Mateo and another devoted to St. John the Baptist. He also painted a retablo for the parochial church of La Puebla de Alburton in the province of Saragossa, and a second altarpiece for the same church with six scenes of the Annunciation to Mary a couple of years later. All of this is known from archival records. Unfortunately, we don't have the works. Bonafos Abansu, who made the frame for the La Seo altarpiece, was one of many Jewish silversmiths in Saragossa. Recent research in the archives of the Crown or Kingdom of Aragon has revealed that the Jewish silversmiths of Saragossa were so numerous that they supported their own synagogue. In Morella, Aragon, the earliest recorded silversmith was a Jew, Moshe Alfoidar, known in the records as, quote, the Jewish silversmith, end quote, in documents of 1334-5. The Santa Linea family of silversmiths, who dominated the profession in Morello in the second half of the 14th century, were conversos. The prominence of Jews in silversmithing may be a heritage from their roles in areas previously under Muslim rule, since the Hadith, the religious traditions of Islam, viewed metalworking as degrading and left it to the Jews. Given a lack of systematic silver marking in medieval Spain, however, it is difficult to connect Jewish silversmiths with specific works. Now, just as the Santa Linea family became conversos, so did painters of altarpieces. Born and educated in the Jewish community, they later converted to Christianity. Among them were two brothers, the de Levis, who were listed as professional artists on the baptismal records. In other words, by the time they were baptized, they already had professions. They were at least in their 20s or something. Juan de Levi created this retablo, this altarpiece that included these two scenes, in a chapel dedicated to the bishops of Tarazona, which is a smaller town not too far from, like 45 minutes today from Saragossa. The bishops of Tarazona, Pedro and Fernando Perez Calvillo, were two brothers who succeeded one another in office around 1400. The existing biographical information on them indicates that there's no information prior to their conversion, to their baptism, again, which means that they too may have been converts from Judaism. It is well known that conversos often engaged in business with one another, and a similar sense of fraternity may have led Fernando to commission the altarpiece for his brother's tomb from Juan de Levi. In a town that's further away, a small town called Rubielos del Amoro, is a retablo with multiple panels that appears to be a work by someone who trained with Juan de Levi. If you look at the facial features, particularly of Jesus, the way the features just lie on the surface and there's no real modeling of them and the proportions and so forth. In the scene on this altarpiece of Jesus among the doctors, which is the scene in which he goes to the temple in Jerusalem and he argues with the rabbis, with the teachers who are there, it is a scene that actually took place in the temple, but it's presented as if it's taking place in a contemporary synagogue. Some of the worshipers are seated on the floor, which we know was a mode of seating described in the texts of Spanish rabbis. And as you can see, two people hold books with correctly formed Hebrew letters, though they don't say anything, but they at least are correctly formed. On this altarpiece, there is also a bottom register, which has pictures of prophets. They're all Jewish figures. They're all Hebrew prophets. There are 12 of them altogether. I apologize for this photograph, but the priest wouldn't open the iron gate, so I was photographing through this grill. I think you can make out Moses, who holds two of the luchot, but he holds one in each hand far apart, and all of them are identified by these rolls with letters. This is an unusually large number of Hebrew prophets for an altarpiece. With continuing study in the Spanish archives, more names of Jewish artists will probably emerge, although a link to actual works will always be difficult given the number of 15th century altarpieces that have physically deteriorated or been painted over at a later date. I would now like to talk about how Jewish artists worked with Christian artists. In 1941, the renowned art historian Millard Meese published an article in which he linked an altarpiece, this one, dedicated to St. Mark, that is now in the Morgan Library. If you go to the Morgan Library, I mean, it used to be there for years, so I presume it's still in the same place. So you go into Morgan's study, and you look at the bookcases, there's a shelf along the back, and that's where this altarpiece is. Millard Meese linked this altarpiece to several manuscripts and suggested that they were made in one shop. And the reason he did so had to do with the figure style. Here are some of the figures on the altarpiece. And this is a manuscript that is a record of the coronation, the consecration. It's a handbook for the consecration and coronation of the kings of Aragon. And you can see the same elongated figures that are hidden by their draperies with nicely modeled heads. Now, after he published this article and listed a couple of manuscripts, what was important from Meese's research was the fact that two types of art were made in one workshop. When I was a new PhD, I actually got up at a conference and suggested that the same artist who carved ivories might have carved something on the facade of a church, and I was like beaten down. This was, it was inconceivable. But Meese proved that there were these two types of works that were being made in one workshop, and that was very significant. Then along came another art historian who discussed the relationship between these works. This was Francis Wormald, right? And discussed the relationship between the figure style in a Moran Nebuchim, a Guide to the Perplexed, now in Copenhagen in the Royal Library, and the other manuscripts in the group, and the retablo in the Morgan Library. And after that, there were several other people, including Gabriel Sedrina, who brought two more Hebrew manuscripts, two or three more Hebrew manuscripts into the discussion, and further Latin manuscripts, Psalter and others were linked together. And now the whole workshop is considered to be under the tutelage of an artist known as Ferrer Bassa, who died in the plague of 1348. So that all this work was done prior to that. In fact, that is the last date for this manuscript, which until then had been the only one with any kind of date. But now they prove through the records that there are no more records of him after 1348, so it's thought that he passed away at that time. So what I would like to sum up now is to show you the way in which these mixed workshops could impact on the creation of works for both Jews and Christians. Now, on the right is a page from a very well-known Haggadah of 1320. There are a group of Haggadot that were made in Castile and also around Barcelona, beginning around 1300. And what's interesting about them is that the whole type of decoration, which includes the usual word panels, it includes text illustrations, but also a prefatory series of miniatures on biblical themes, seems to have sprung full-blown from the head of Zeus, as the Greeks would say, because there's no Haggadot beforehand with a few miniatures or one of each, as if they're trying something out and then it fully develops. They're all developed. They all appear in this format. Well, I think what we learned from these has to guide us in looking at the context for these Haggadot and to see it not just in Jewish art, but to see it in the context of Spanish art. This is part of an altarpiece dedicated actually to St. Andrew, which is in the cloisters. And when I walked into the storeroom, my jaw dropped, because this was, I was looking at the same diapered background that you have on the golden Haggadah, the same positioning of the figures relative to the ground, these trees that are sometimes meaningful and sometimes just ornamental, and then there are certain patterns, this scene of the making of the fowl and so forth. This is very close to another Haggadah. So obviously there was a borrowing back and forth, which was the consequence of Jews working in the same shops as Christians. And in fact, the Mora Nevuchim that I showed you before has another page, which looks as if it could have been lifted out of a Byzantine manuscript, a Byzantine Gospels, because it has a page with the four animals of Ezekiel, which are the same animals as the four animals of the evangelists, and in the same kind of composition. Okay. These Haggadot are also, this is an aside, noteworthy for giving us details of daily life. On the right, you have one of the prefatory scenes, which shows the preparations for Pesach, which is, you know, very suitable for today. And this is the Hispano-Moresque Haggadah, which is dated around 1300. And it too has stylistic relationships to altar pieces. And here is the man who is baking and the other people who are bringing the dough and taking away the matzah. And then we have this very famous, or infamous, I should say, because it was discussed in this popular book on the Sarajevo Haggadah. What's it called? I forgot.
People of the Book.
People of the Book, yeah. In which the writer makes a big deal out of this one figure. But it's interesting to see the family The fact that they used a hanging lamp, how many objects they had on the table, and notice this headdress, which was kind of the mark of a Jewish woman and appears in many different contexts, both in Jewish and Christian art. So the miniatures are not just biblical, but they also have these scenes from daily life. And here's another one from the Sarajevo Haggadah. My students are sick of this. I show this in so many contexts because it's so wonderfully informative about the ceremonial art that existed in Spain, of which we have nothing left. And I think we can only reconstruct it by looking at these miniatures and then tracing the forms in the Sephardi diaspora. So what you have here is the scene where people have gone to the synagogue for a service before the Seder, and now they're going home, and the sexton is closing the ark. And there's this wonderful depiction of three Torah scrolls with silk mantles, and they flare outward, notice, and they have fringe at the bottom, which is exactly what you get in Italy, the Ottoman Empire, Amsterdam, all the places to which the Sephardim emigrated. Okay, when I started to look at these pieces, I wondered how you could really tell who was a Jew or whether these were Jews. And it was only by researching laws and also customs and clothing of the period I was able to be convinced myself that we were looking at Jews. And one of the scenes in a Christian manuscript that depicted Jew is this frontispiece from a Bible known as the Biblia d'Alba, the Alba Bible, which is now today in Madrid. And it's a Bible that's very extensive. The man who commissioned the Bible, who was enthroned here, was the ruler or the head of a military order. And he felt that all the existing translations of the Bible into Castilian were rather lousy, and he wanted a better translation. And so he commissioned a rabbi, and this is all we know about this rabbi. He was Moses from Aragel. And if you look here, you will see him depicted. So he's the expert, and yet every time he appears in the miniatures of this manuscript, he's wearing a big cloak. The cloak has a sign on it, a circular sign called a rotulus, which distinguished Jews. And his hair flows freely. It is not cut. And all of these characteristics of Rabbi Moses have to do with the laws that were passed in Spain. In 1215, Pope Innocent III had convened the Fourth Lateran Council, which stipulated that Jews must dress differently so that they were identifiable, thereby preventing sexual relations between Christians and Jews. Exactly how this would be accomplished was left to local authorities. And here's a description from the law code of Alfonso X, which dates in the second half of the 13th century, but which was adopted in all of Spain by 1348. And it says, many crimes and outrageous things occur between Christians and Jews because they live together in cities and dress alike. And in order to avoid the offenses and evils which take place for this reason, we deem it proper and we order that all Jews, male and female, living in our dominions shall bear some distinguishing mark upon them so that people may plainly recognize a Jew or a Jewess. In 1263, James I of Aragon obligated his Jewish subjects to wear an outside cape bearing the red colored circle that you see here. The beard was a sign of difference and alterity, a compulsory for both Muslims and Jews. And they can be seen already, this can be seen already in, actually, no, I guess not, okay. Even in earlier manuscripts of the 13th century, like the Cantigas de Santa Maria. It's very interesting that there's even a Jewish commentary on this. There was a man named Shlomo Alami, who was born in Spain in 1370 and died in Portugal in 1420. And he wrote an Igeret HaMusar, or a treatise on moral behavior, in 1415. And this is what he said. "We have suffered measure for measure. Because we adopted their dress, they required of us different vestments so that we would seem to be strangers among them. And because we shortened the corners of our hair and beards, they forced us to let our hair grow as if we were plunged into deep mourning." The laws of the church regarding appearance had an impact on the painting of medieval altarpieces. If Jewish characters were required for a scene from Christian history, the artist depicted his Jewish contemporaries in the roles of their ancestors who lived at the time of Jesus and the apostles, recalling St. Augustine's view that Jews were witnesses to events occurring in the early centuries of Christianity. But late medieval Jews were always shown bearded and dressed in the cloaks required by contemporary law. I would now like to show you the types or the ways in which Jews were depicted on altarpieces. They were the kings and prophets, such as the ones you saw at Rubiela's. They appear on many altarpieces, usually on the predella, that is the bottom register. And as you can see here, this is an altarpiece from Saragossa, the altarpiece of Santa Cruz. You have relatively straightforward depictions. There's no, but however, they seem to be portraits. I mean, there are blemishes on the faces of some of these figures, which are, you can see them in the exhibition. I think that because they're placed at the bottom of the altarpiece, which is on the viewer's eye level, they achieve a greater significance than they would normally. There are also scenes that depict contemporary persecution of Jews. This is an altarpiece of St. Stephen, which is in the Museum for Catalan Art in Barcelona. And I'm going to focus on this scene in which Stephen is preaching in a synagogue. This is symbolic of the forced conversionist sermons that were part of the Jewish life in the 14th and 15th centuries. And you can see the wonderful range of reactions that the artist has captured. So you have one man who doesn't want to hear what the saint has to say altogether. But this man has heard it, and he's tearing up his sitter. And two people are arguing with the saint and so forth. So you have the full range of Jewish reaction to somebody who's trying to convert them. Now, there were also depictions of baptism, forced baptism, in which one knows that it's a Jewish baptism because the man has a beard. There are some striking scenes that have to do with the charge of host desecration. The Lateran Council of 1215 that I mentioned before had many interesting clauses. And another one established that the people should be made aware of the moment when the host becomes the body of Jesus. In other words, it's transformed into the body of Jesus. And that moment is called transubstantiation. So the people should see this. And that was one of the reasons for creating these altarpieces that sat at the back of the altarpiece instead of at the front, so that people could see the priest raising the host and this crucial moment in the Mass. As soon as this happened, 1215, by the end of the century, Jews were being accused of desecrating the host. And there are a number of, this is a detail from that altarpiece, in which this man, this obviously Jewish man, is hitting the host, and the blood is coming out, and miraculously this child representing Jesus comes out of a cauldron. Here's the wife with that headdress again, and a child who are, you know, sort of standing in horror, as if, you know, they were two steps down the road to conversion away from Judaism. There were here are other depictions of this scene. There are two altarpieces that look like this one here. Again, the host is being stabbed. And okay, and all of this was the desecration of the host was a much more potent accusation against the Jews in Spain than was the blood libel. It's interesting that there's a very famous painting in Italy where the predella, the bottom section, is done by Uccello that depicts the same story. And yet there was never any charge of a desecration of the host at all, ever, in Italy. So the theme just migrated perhaps through art history. So there were many altarpieces then that showed aspects of Jewish life in this period. Now I'd like to, Jews also appear in scenes from Christian history, from the history of the time of Jesus and the early saints. And this is from that altarpiece of Santa Cruz that we looked at before. Helena, the mother of Constantine, figures very prominently in this altarpiece. She is the woman who, after her son, recognized Christianity as a bona fide religion in the Roman Empire. She took herself off to the land of Palestine, and she is the one who identified all the sites that you see, that you now go to Israel and you see signs that this is where Jesus did this and that and so forth. And one of these episodes had to do with the finding of the true cross, that she wanted to find the cross on which Jesus had been crucified, and a Jew named Judas claimed to know where it was. And he is being interrogated here. But this scene is not taking place, obviously, in Eretz Yisrael. It's taking place inside a Jewish quarter, which is entered through an arch. Most of the Jewish quarters, for example, in Aragon, are entered through arches, nearly all of them. So this is a mark that she's come into this Jewish space, and that's where this interrogation is taking place. And you notice, too, in contrasting these two figures, how, you know, perfect her features are and how blemish-free and so forth, whereas his are, he has sunken cheeks and so forth. And this contrast between the holy Christian figure and the Jewish figure occurs throughout the altarpieces. Now, in addition, what I would like to turn now to is the notion that we can see in these altarpieces also elements of Jewish life. But I think my slide got out of order. One second. Okay, I'm going to come back where I was, but I want to talk about this, about two scenes that show Jews as part of Christian theology. This is a scene which should be identified as the disputation between Moses and Peter. These were staged arguments, staged debates on the relative merits of Judaism and Christianity that took place in Spain, most Notably, there was one in which Nachmanides was involved, and then there was one later in Tortosa. Now here we have Moses with Luchot again. You'll notice that the Luchot don't read from bottom to top as normally, but they read across. And Peter, who is always this type of figure, a kind of very muscular figure with gray hair, holds a scroll that's not inscribed. And I got up at a conference and I was discussing this and I said, for some reason or other, the scroll is not inscribed. And a fellow came over to me afterwards, he says, when the scroll is not inscribed, it's because the artist didn't know the language. So this, in effect, is a proof that not just the positive presence of Hebrew, but also the lack of Latin, that we must have a Jewish artist who was creating the scene. And I think that although a lot of these altarpieces are identified and contracts exist with Christian artists, that obviously they had helpers. And sometimes those helpers were Jewish. Now there's a historical character named Petrus Alphonsus, who was a very famous converso of the 12th century. And before he converted, he was Moshe. And after he converted, he was Petrus, he was Peter. And so this scene seems to reflect his personal history and not just simply be a disputation. His work, by the way, a dialogue that he wrote about Judaism and Christianity was so popular that there are 56 manuscripts that exist of his writings, copies of his writings. And in a more positive sense, I want to show you as a last instance of Jewish theology, Christian theology, which involves Jews, I want to show you this miracle of the loaves and the fishes, and I apologize for the left slide. Here is Jesus multiplying the loaves and the fishes to feed the multitude. And when you analyze the multitudes, you see here and here, what you have is a mix of Jews and Christians. And when I saw this, I actually went up to Benji Gampel, Professor Gampel, here, and I said, what is going on here? And he said, try Joachim of Fiori. Joachim of Fiori was a 12th century monk who had a vision of the end of days, of messianic times, that involved Jews and Christians coming together in one religion. That their saints will be our saints was a kind of logo that or slogan that his followers adopted. And his philosophy was extremely popular in Spain. And finally, I'd just like to show you how some of these altarpieces show Jewish life. This altarpiece, or panel from an altarpiece, is from a small town called Ejea de los Caballeros. And it's a huge altarpiece. It goes from the, you know, almost the floor to the heights of the vaults in this parish church. And in one of the scenes, which is the most popular, one of the most popular scenes of Jesus' life, is his presentation in the temple. This is when he's brought to the temple for his circumcision. And you have Mary, and behind her, Joseph. Joseph has the two birds that are the offering of a woman of modest means after giving birth. You have the high priest, and then there's this object sitting on the altar. And I one day was staring at this and staring at it and trying to figure out what Christian object this was, when I realized it wasn't a Christian object, it was a Jewish object. It was a teak, a case for the Torah. And they once, and they occur in many altarpieces. In other words, just as the Jews of the 14th and 15th centuries represented the Jews of antiquity, so too the synagogues represented the temple. Because in the Middle Ages, nobody knew what the temple looked like. There hadn't been any excavations. It was a mystery, you know. Nobody knew what it looked like. And so here, how do you imagine it then? It was the place of worship of the Jews. And so they used synagogue architecture. All of these buildings have nothing about them that characterizes them as churches. Okay. And here's another striking example. Here, the theme of the presentation becomes explicit. This is a panel from an altarpiece that's in the Hispanic Society on 155th Street. It's a great place. If you have never been there, you should go. They have a wealth of treasures. And here's this other, another presentation. There's Joseph and Mary and the child. But then there are these two objects on the altar. And they are a becher, a cup for wine, and a knife with a curved blade. The same kind of knife that was used all over the Sephardi diaspora. Now, we don't have any of these knives from Spain because all the precious metals, anything in precious metals, was confiscated at the time of the expulsion. Even Torah curtains were burned to extract the silver and gold used in their embroideries. So this is, it's by comparing this again to works that it still exists. This is one from Morocco to which the Sephardim fled, where you have this curved, side to the knife shows you that they are continuing a tradition. And then I have to say, in a case of life imitating art, in 2003, this synagogue was uncovered in Lorca, which is in the south. It's in the province of Murcia. Like if you, if the Granada is here, it's over to the east, borders on the Mediterranean. And they were building a parador. And luckily in Spain, every building you do in a historic area has to have an archaeologist on the team. And she saw this, medieval wall, and this was excavated. So notice what you have. You have, there was a vestibule, there was an entryway into this foyer area. Then this is the, actually the steps leading up to the teva, the reader's desk, and the ark was here. And all around are benches along the walls, stone benches. And this is a retablo in the Metropolitan Museum, which shows the same arrangement, people sitting along the walls. And even till today, the other seats are parallel to those along the walls. And you have this long staircase up to the reader's desk, and the ark behind. This is, again, Jesus among the doctors. And when we hung this painting in the exhibition, I went over to it. And, well, let me tell you first that underneath the teva, they found a cache of shards of glass. Glass was very expensive in the Middle Ages. And so these pieces of glass were kept, and they sat there, and people reconstructed on molds 40 or 50 glass lamps, so that we now have glass lamps that we can see always in synagogues and in miniatures and Haggadot. And I went up to this painting and I started looking at the lamp, and there was a Hebrew inscription. And the reason I was prompted to do that was because I knew in Morocco people are memorialized with lamps hanging in the synagogue, and their names are written around the circumference of the lamp, glass lamps in which oil is put. And that's exactly what was done here, except the person seems to be, from the inscription, to have been alive rather than deceased. So this is really an extraordinary painting, I think, for the way that it mirrors the actual archaeology and gives us a real feeling for Jewish life of the period. Okay. And finally, I just want to show you this one, also from the Metropolitan, which is from an altar, the first scene of an altarpiece for St. John the Baptist. St. John the Baptist's father, Zacharias, was a Kohen Gedol. He was an ordinary priest in the temple. Here, however, we have a scene of the Annunciation to Zacharias, in which he's being told that he's going to have a son. But he's depicted, as you can tell, as being the high priest. And so there are pendants on his tunic, which might be the bells or the pomegranates or whatever. Here's another teak on the altar. And then there's this wonderful detail of this rope. Does anybody know what that's for?
If he faints or collapses, they can pull him out.
Right, or if he's killed because he didn't do the service correctly. And this is not ordinary knowledge, you know. This is something you know either because you went to the synagogue or you studied Masechet Yoma or something. This is not knowledge of that would, I think, ordinarily be available to Christians, and is another indication of how Jewish life was known. Now, how would this knowledge have been transmitted? Besides the fact that Jews worked for Christian artists, I think that it's important to realize that many of these towns were very, you know, they had 1,000 people. A town like Ejea de los Caballeros, that I showed you the teak in the altarpiece, there were 1,000 people, and 270 of them were Jews. The Juderias, the Jewish quarters, were quarters that Jews elected to live in. They weren't forced to live in them. They wanted to be protected, and so they had walls built. So sometimes Jews lived outside the quarters, and sometimes they lived in the quarters. And then there were the conversos, who many of whom continued to practice aspects of Jewish life even after their conversion to Christianity. I had an archivist took me to a town, I forget what town it was, and we went up to, he says, now the synagogue was over there. You know, he figures this all out on the basis of documents. He said, the synagogue was here, and here is where the conversos came on Saturdays and listened to the service outside the synagogue. We should also realize that it's known that Jews went to services in churches because they wanted to listen to the sermons and to hear speakers, and that Christians came to Jewish services for the same reason. As a result of all of this, there was a movement of knowledge about one another, or a growth of knowledge about one another that seems incredible to us today. I think this record of Jewish life on the altarpieces of Aragon and Castile is a precious one. Manuscripts were the only art form that Jews were allowed to take with them into exile in 1492, and the few genre scenes they contain yield only a partial glimpse of Jewish life. The figures that inhabit these miniatures of preparations and celebrations of Passover are largely stereotypical, but the larger scale of the altarpieces and the superior skill of their artists afford us actual, particularized portraits of Jews who lived in the 14th and 15th centuries, and details of their dress and surroundings. Their inclusion on the retablos exemplifies the social interaction that characterized Iberian society and which has been termed conviventia. The Jewish and Christian artists of medieval Aragon and their patrons exemplified the best of conviventia, a word which Thomas Glick has defined as coexistence, but with connotations of mutual interpenetration and creative influence, even as it also embraces the phenomena of mutual friction, rivalry, and suspicion.
Thank you.